Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to tonight's program of the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley, brought to you from the 4th Street Summit Center in downtown San Jose. My name is Colleen Wilcox, and I'll be your chair for this evening. Tonight's program would not have been possible without the support from the Health Trust and co-sponsor for the evening, Hicklebee's Children's Bookstore. It is a pleasure to introduce Eric Schlosser, correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly and author of Chew on This, Everything You Don't Want to Know About Fast Food. With obesity, and more importantly, children's obesity, being a front page story in newspapers across the country, it's hard to believe that we still have a national epidemic on our hands. There are more than 9 million overweight and obese children living in the United States alone, and one out of every 5 public schools serves some brand of fast foods to their children. In 1999, Eric Schlosser wrote a startling article in Rolling Stones magazine, which exposed the hidden truth about the fast food industry. The story became the foundation for Fast Food Nation, the dark side of the all-American meal, which was on the New York Times bestsellers list for more than 2 years and has been translated into over 20 different languages. A movie version of the book is being produced by Participant Productions with a big screen debut this month at the prestigious Cannes Film Festival. Please join me in welcoming Eric Schlosser.
Well, thank you. I want to thank the Commonwealth Club and the Health Trust for bringing me here to San Jose this evening. And I'm going to speak about the high cost of this food to America's children, the high cost of very cheap food. But first I'm going to say a few words about how I came to write a children's book. My previous book was about the black market economy in the United States. And the book I'm working on right now is about the prison system. So I don't seem like a natural children's book author based on those interests of mine. When I was writing Fast Food Nation, I was very, very concerned about the possibility of being sued. Oprah Winfrey had recently been sued by the meatpacking industry. Members of Greenpeace in England had been passing out pamphlets in the street, had not only been sued by McDonald's, but had been investigated by their private eyes and pursued, had their group infiltrated. And I knew that my book might be controversial. So when I finished Fast Food Nation and I was doing all the footnotes, I decided to hire a fact-checker from the New Yorker magazine, which has a legendary fact-checking department. And I wanted someone who would attack everything that I wrote, challenge its accuracy, and pretend to be a meatpacking or a fast food researcher or executive. So that person was named Charles Wilson, and I'd never met him before, and we began with a very adversarial relationship because I take great pride in my work. I try very hard always to be accurate, and he was constantly challenging me on minute factual assertions, and I would go back up and argue with him. So our friendship, our relationship really began with a great deal of arguing over statistics that most people really couldn't care less about. Out of that came a strong friendship, and he worked as the fact checker on my next book on the black market economy. And he came to me a couple of years ago. His family has a small children's book publishing company in West Virginia. And he said, you know, you should do a children's book that is similar to Fast Food Nation and takes those subjects and those themes and addresses it to younger readers, because it's children who are being targeted by the fast food chains, and they need access to this information. And I thought that was a pretty good idea, and I recruited him to help me with it. And so now there is a book called Chew on This that is aimed at children age 9 to 13 and is trying to tell them all the things that the fast food ads don't tell them. The fast food ads are full of happy children, happy families, friendship, lots of thin people, very, very little information about the food, where it comes from, how it's made, and most importantly of all, what can happen to you when you eat it and when you eat too much of it. We have now a generation of children that is probably more alienated from food production, from understanding where food comes from, than any other in our history. 100 years ago, a book like this would have been completely unnecessary, not just because there wasn't a fast food industry, but because children 100 years ago didn't need to be taught where their food came from. They were most likely quite involved in producing it themselves, either helping their families on the farm or on the ranch, helping their families prepare the food at home, or in urban areas, the sorts of markets that existed 100 years ago told you very clearly where the food came from. Sides of beef in a butcher shop, farmers' markets with fresh produce. So it's only recently that children can live lives completely, blissfully, unaware of their food, of their food system, and what happens when you eat this food. One of the reasons that I wrote this book is that we are facing, quite simply, a public health catastrophe, a catastrophe confronting Americans' children. There is a nutritionist at the University of Colorado, who I quote in the book, who says, quite bluntly, we have the fattest, least fit generation of kids in our history in this country. And it's not just an aesthetic issue. It's not just that the self-image of these children is being harmed. We have a society that is preaching a culture of thinness and creating totally unrealistic body images for children. And at the same time, we have gigantic industries encouraging them to eat more and more, to eat more and more of food that is going to make them unhealthy. And so once children become obese, they not only have to deal with the emotional problems that it can cause, but serious, serious health problems. When I mentioned public health, and I was saying this earlier this evening, public health is almost a quaint, old-fashioned idea today, simply because it has the word public in it. For the last 20 years, the political culture of this country has emphasized the private at every turn over the public. And we have had a privatization of one aspect of society after another that was traditionally the role of government to provide. And I think one of the effects of this privatization has been a loss of a sense of compassion and connection to the people at the very bottom of this society. And when you look at who is suffering the worst consequences by far of this food and the worst health consequences of this food, it is the people who are the poorest and the least able to afford not only the healthy food, but adequate medical care. And I would argue, and I think we will soon see, that even if there is a lack of compassion on a moral and an ethical level for people at the bottom of this society, we are going to soon face a financial disaster that is going to encourage, and I think is very quickly encouraging, state health authorities and public health authorities and even corporations now to start thinking about this obesity epidemic. Now, what has happened in this country has happened slowly and inexorably. It's almost like the proverbial frog that is put into water, and the heat is slowly turned up, and the frog is boiled before it knows that it's even in any danger. Our food has changed more in the previous 30 years, I would argue, than in the previous 30,000. Truly, mankind survived for millennia without the McNugget. The McNugget is a new thing. There was never a McNugget in public consumption until the year 1983. So it's very, very hard, especially with children, to make clear to them that our food system hasn't always been this way. As a matter of fact, the fast food industry is really a product on a mass scale of the last 25 to 30 years. And so many of these health problems have occurred in the same corresponding period. And they occur slowly and incrementally, and people become ill slowly. If the harmful effects of eating trans fat-laden French fries were apparent a half hour after you ate them, we wouldn't have the same health problems that we do today. But they are slow and insidious effects. And again, it's our children who are most at risk. So I'm going to talk a little bit about how these companies target children and why they target children. I mentioned that this industry is relatively recent. Well, the first McDonald's was in 1948. But McDonald's really had a negligible impact on our culture and on our food system until really the early 1970s. The first McDonald's was in 1968. It was in 1948, but by 1968, there were only 1,000 McDonald's. And in a country of this size, that doesn't have a very big impact on how food is produced, processed, and marketed. Well, there were 1,000 in 1968. Today, there are 15,000 McDonald's in the United States. There are 30,000 worldwide. And in the United States, there are hundreds of thousands of restaurants serving similar food produced in similar ways. I talk about McDonald's not because it's an evil company. I don't believe that. I don't believe the executives are bad people. I believe that this is a company that has tremendous power over our food system, and I believe that its executives are very, very slow to recognize the consequences of their actions and take full responsibility for them. So McDonald's begins in 1948 as this little hamburger stand in San Bernardino. Well, today, McDonald's is a powerhouse over our food system. McDonald's is the biggest purchaser of beef in the United States, biggest purchaser of chicken, of potatoes, which are the most widely consumed vegetable in this country, biggest purchaser of pork, and now even the biggest purchaser of lettuce and of apples. And the system that McDonald's put in place to create its food came out of a very, very specific point in our history. The fast food industry is really the creation of California culture in the 1950s, very specifically Southern California post-war culture, car culture. Southern California was home to the aerospace industry with a real worship of science and technology. And Los Angeles was the first city in the history of the world created really to serve the needs of the automobile. This is where McDonald's and the fast food industry came out of. A real belief in speed and convenience and technology. This was when Disney was promoting the idea of, we would all live in plastic houses one day and drive around in nuclear power cars, and chemical companies were preaching better living through chemistry. So there was a real faith in the limitless power and potential of science. And in McDonald's and the fast food industry, we see its fervent application to our food. Now, when McDonald's first started, again, I talk about them because they provided the template for this industry, not only the most powerful, but the most influential. When McDonald's first started, for its first 20 years, it served freshly peeled potatoes that were peeled in the back of the restaurant. It served fresh ground beef. And it really didn't have a big impact on our food system. But the desire to grow and grow at a large speed and grow nationwide had a huge impact on its purchasing policies. Ray Kroc, who was the founder of the McDonald's Corporation, really believed in uniformity and conformity and everything tasting exactly the same at thousands of different locations. And in order to do that, and in order to do that inexpensively, you could no longer serve fresh food with fresh ingredients. He didn't want to have to employ short-order cooks who might earn a good wage. So McDonald's in the late 1960s and early 1970s switched from fresh ingredients to frozen ingredients. And in doing so, switched, for example, from 175 different suppliers of ground beef to only five. McDonald's led the way, really, in the industrialization of our livestock production, in the centralization of much of our agriculture, and in the creation of this entirely new kind of food, an industrial food that came not out of a small butcher shop, not out of a farm stand, but came out of enormous processing plants. A fundamental change. And this is significant because very early on, McDonald's made the decision to target children with this food. At first, it seemed innocent enough. A lollipop distributed to school children, encouraging them to go to McDonald's. A clown, Ronald McDonald, who began with a franchisee in Washington, D.C. in the early 1960s. The first Ronald McDonald was Willard Scott, who later became the weatherman on the Today Show. He came up with the name Ronald McDonald. He created the character. It was a very popular character. It was so popular that when McDonald's decided to take him nationwide, that is Ronald, they decided to fire Willard Scott. And the reason that Willard Scott was fired is quite revealing. He was a little bit pudgy. And McDonald's didn't want a pudgy Ronald. So you will notice that Ronald is always quite thin. And he never, ever is photographed eating the food, which may or may not be a coincidence. So McDonald's borrowed a great deal from the Disney playbook. Ray Kroc knew Walt Disney well. They served in the same World War I ambulance corps. Disney was really a titan in Southern California and had perfected marketing to children, and especially a form of synergy. Disney wasn't really selling one specific product to children. He was selling a brand that had the connotations of happiness, of a feeling. Disneyland was the happiest place on earth, and it was just coincidental that you could buy many, many different things for children at that one place. But it was an idea of happiness. And when McDonald's began to really aggressively target children, it borrowed a great deal, I think, from Disney. McDonald Land, which was the subject of the first McDonald's television commercial, was designed by some former Disney designers. The theme song was written by composers who had worked for Disney. And again, there wasn't an emphasis on any one product, and certainly not an emphasis on where this food came from. It was an idea that was being sold to children, and that idea was happiness, a happy meal. So what started perhaps innocently enough really began to change in the late 70s and the 80s as the techniques of marketing to children were perfected. Now, what are some of those techniques? Well, it no longer involves just giving a child a lollipop. The major food marketers now hire child psychologists and social anthropologists to study children carefully, carefully, and cater their marketing to them. In the book, we have a photograph that you won't be able to see if I hold up, but the cutting edge right now of researching children is called neuromarketing. Neuromarketing involves putting a young child into an MRI machine and showing him or her television ads while their brain patterns can be studied. And there is a certain part of the brain that marketers now think is connected to brand loyalty. And they are putting children into MRI machines. This is state of the art. Who are they targeting? They are targeting children as young as possible because research has found that brand loyalty can begin as young as the age of 2. And not only that, some children can recognize brand logos before they can recognize the sound of their own name. These brand logos sometimes are very archetypal, very powerful images. And at one point, McDonald's was thinking about getting rid of the Golden Arches and hired an industrial psychologist to study if this was a good idea. And the industrial psychologist that they hired came back and said, "Don't do it. Don't get rid of the Golden Arches." The Golden Arches symbolize Mother McDonald's breasts. Think about that next time you see them. Very large breasts, and perhaps of appealing symbolic importance, not only to toddlers, but to their target demographic of college-age young men. In any event, what started innocently enough became something very different. And you will now find that the major fast food chains have very close marketing relationships with the big Hollywood studios, with the television networks, the children's television networks, the leading cartoon characters, the leading sports stars, the leading pop stars. There is hardly any aspect of children's emotional life that is now immune from fast food marketing. And one of the areas that until recently was immune was the school systems. And yet the school systems are now being flooded with fast food chains operating in the schools and the soda companies working hand in hand with the fast food industry. And that relationship is a very close one. It is in the interest of the fast food chains that people drink more soda. McDonald's is the biggest purveyor of Coca-Cola in the world. And the reason that they can sell dollar cheeseburgers is because people are usually thirsty when they buy those dollar cheeseburgers, and the Coca-Cola is extremely, extremely profitable. Now, we could argue, and we could have an interesting debate over the ethics of marketing to children, keeping in mind that very young children cannot differentiate between what is an advertisement and what is entertainment. And some of the most, to me, despicable marketing has been the use of the Teletubbies, who are fictional characters aimed at pre-verbal children who have been used to sell fast food, both by Burger King and McDonald's. Burger King went so far as to sell chicken nuggets shaped as Teletubbies. So this is marketing aimed at pre-verbal children, quite consciously. And we can debate, should there be marketing to children or shouldn't there be marketing to children? That's one debate. But another debate would be, if you're going to target 14-month-old children with food, isn't there some obligation to sell them food that's healthy for them to eat? What are you trying to sell is as important to me as whom you're trying to sell towards. So what has been the consequence of this intense marketing for the last 25 years aimed at very young children? Well, the rise of fast food and soda consumption over the last 25 to 30 years has been astronomical, and so has the rise of obesity that accompanies it. And I think it's no accident. If you look at the food that the major fast food chains have been selling to young children, it is consistently high in calories, very large portion sizes, high in fat, high in salt, high in sugar, high in simple starches, very low in complex carbohydrates, very low in fiber, very low in micronutrients. They have been marketing to children food that really is the ideal food to make you unhealthy if you eat it in large amounts. And they have, particularly in the last 5 to 10 years, been targeting children in low-income communities, and have separate advertising agencies to target Latino children and African-American children. So what's been the impact of this mass marketing over the last 25 to 30 years? Well, our diet has changed considerably. Today, one out of every five American toddlers eats French fries every single day. One out of every five eating French fries every day. And soda consumption has skyrocketed, especially among children. It has tripled. Soda consumption has tripled among teenage boys. The typical American in 1975, just as the fast food industry was starting to grow, drank about 27 gallons of soda a year. Today, the typical American drinks 54 gallons of soda a year. And if any of you here in the audience don't drink any soda, that means someone's drinking about 108 gallons a year. That's how these averages work. Now, a 12-ounce can of soda contains the equivalent of 9 or 10 teaspoons of sugar. And many of these soda portions are much longer than that. And it is quite possible, when you order a big gulp, to get 30 or 40 teaspoons of sugar, the equivalent of it, in that soda. And if it's a hot day, if it's a very hot day, it's easy to drink that much of a very cold, sugary drink. Since the early 1970s, the obesity rate among American toddlers has doubled. The obesity rate among American children aged 6 to 11 has tripled. This is a disaster, because if you are obese by the age of 13, the odds are overwhelming that you're going to be obese for the rest of your life. Now, obesity isn't just a problem that causes emotional pain to children. There was one study done in this state that found that obese children showed signs of depression very similar to those of children undergoing chemotherapy. So this has a huge emotional cost in this culture of thinness that we have. But more importantly, it has huge physical costs, tremendous physical costs. Obesity has been linked to an increased risk for asthma, increased risk of heart disease, of cancer, and particularly of diabetes. And we are seeing an epidemic of juvenile diabetes. Diabetes among children used to be exceedingly, exceedingly rare. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention came out with a study a few years ago that estimates that one out of three American children born in the year 2000 will develop diabetes as a result of being obese or overweight. And when you look at the children in minority communities, the CDC estimates that one out of every two Latino and African American children will develop diabetes. This is a disaster. The estimates already are that obesity and the health illnesses connected to obesity are already costing the United States conservatively about $100 billion a year. The estimate for the state of California conservatively is $8 to $9 billion now. What is this going to cost us when one out of every two or one out of every three people in this society needs some kind of very, very expensive intervention for diabetes? The dollar menu right now does not include the real cost of the food, because that dollar cheeseburger doesn't include the cost of the dialysis that many of the people who eat these frequently are going to have to go through. This problem has now spread overseas, and as the American fast food diet has spread overseas, we have seen so many of the same health problems. One place that's very, very interesting to look at and also very alarming is the island of Okinawa off Japan. The Okinawa diet has been considered by many to be the healthiest diet, or one of the healthiest diets in the world. Small amounts of fish, of soy, fresh fruits and vegetables, a little bit of meat. Okinawa per capita has traditionally had more people who live past 100 than anywhere else in the world. The Okinawans tended to be short, but they lived a long time. And all of that is changing, and changing very rapidly. The American military has huge bases in Okinawa. American food and the American diet came to Okinawa before the rest of Japan. McDonald's opened in Okinawa in the early 1970s. Okinawa now has more hamburger restaurants per capita than anywhere else in Japan. It also has the highest obesity rate of anywhere in Japan, and life expectancy is falling in Okinawa. And there are grandparents who have followed this traditional diet who are going to outlive their children, and maybe even their grandchildren in some cases. This food has profound impact on people's health. So what should we do about it, and what can be done about it? Well, I am attacked often and very strongly by these industry groups who argue that I am trying to prevent people from having a choice. And they argue that I don't believe in personal responsibility and I don't believe in parental responsibility. Well, I would argue that taking the time and effort to write these two books, and particularly to do the footnotes, which are a real drag, is evidence I care deeply about personal responsibility, even the personal responsibility of children. This children's book addresses children as though they are intelligent. It is not condescending to them. It doesn't try to lecture them, but it tries to provide them with information about what they're eating so that they can become responsible themselves. The goal of Fast Food Nation, the book, was to educate people about how our food system has been profoundly changed and the consequences so that individuals can take responsibility for their own purchasing and their own behavior. So I believe strongly in personal responsibility and parental responsibility. But there's an old-fashioned idea that I also believe in, which is corporate responsibility. Corporate responsibility. If you are the most powerful company in the food system of the United States, you have a profound responsibility for what you're selling to small children. It's as simple as that. Children are a separate category of citizens under the law. And I'm very libertarian. If you've read my work, I really believe in the freedom of adults to purchase what they want, drink if they want to, smoke cigarettes if they want to, as long as they're not harming other people and as long as they're willing to bear the costs of their own behavior. So if an adult wants to go buy three cheeseburgers and three orders of French fries and sit down and eat them all, it's a free country. But I think that children are a separate category of citizens. And we don't allow tobacco companies to market in schools. We don't allow alcohol companies to market in schools. We have a very strong belief in the right to bear arms in this country, which I support to a strong extent. But we don't allow gun companies to market in schools. And yet it's estimated that obesity is going to surpass smoking in the next few years as the single largest cause of preventable death in the United States, and yet we allow companies into the schools to target children, by the way, where their parents are not present. Their parents are not there, and that's one of the reasons these companies want to go into schools. So I am a great believer in personal responsibility, parental responsibility, but also corporate responsibility. I think these companies need to change what they're selling to children. I think they need to change how they're selling to children. I would love for all of this to happen through pressure on these companies from consumers, from concerned parents, from educators, from public health officials. But if that doesn't do it, I believe strongly the government should do it. The government should protect children from exploitation and from harm. And I really believe, ultimately, that the measure of a society is how it looks after its children. That is the future. I believe we are failing them right now when it comes to basic matters of health, and that all of us have a responsibility in reversing these trends and making sure that our children are healthier than we are when they get older, and that their lives are longer than ours have been. So that's my rant for this evening. I would be very interested in any criticism or complaint or hearing from anyone who feels exactly the opposite as I do. Thank you.
Thank you, Eric. I'm Valerie Lewis, co-owner with my sister Monica of Hicklebee's Books in San Jose, and I'll be moderating this evening's question and answer part of our program. And I want to start with this one. In your book, you talk about the word McJob, M-C-J-O-B. It can be found in the Oxford English Dictionary, the American Heritage Dictionary, and the Merriam-Webster Dictionary. Would you define McJob for us, please?
The dictionary definition of McJob is a poorly paid job with little hope of advancement. And McDonald's is very angry that this is now the definition of a McJob. And McDonald's has put out all kinds of press releases trying to change this, and they actually wrote to the dictionary companies to get this definition changed. But I was here in California a couple of years ago when the state of California passed a law obligating all large corporations to provide health insurance to their workers. And in fact, 99% of the large corporations in this state do provide health insurance already to their workers. But there are a few really big companies that don't. Walmart's one of them, and McDonald's is the other. And McDonald's spent hundreds of thousands of dollars to get this legislation overturned, sponsoring television ads that were completely misleading and distorting the truth. So when they say that their McJobs aren't McJobs, I don't believe them on that issue. And if some companies like Starbucks and Costco and another food chain, Panera Bread, can provide decent health benefits to their workers in the service sector, there's really no reason why McDonald's, as the biggest, wealthiest, and most powerful company, can't do the same. So the measure of a McJob is really going to be how McDonald's treats its workers. And at the moment, I think it's not very good.
Since you wrote your first book, have you seen any changes, positive or negative, in the way the fast food industry does business?
I have seen some positive changes. And I think there is the beginning of an awareness that the 20th century model that they so vigorously followed of uniformity and conformity and not taking responsibility may harm them in the long term. So there have been some healthy menu items introduced for the first time. And in terms of the food production, McDonald's has begun, I think, to take steps towards food safety that I support. McDonald's has really asked its suppliers to cut down on the use of antibiotics in livestock feed. McDonald's has pushed for much tougher mad cow regulations than the federal government and deserves some credit for that. And McDonald's has also put pressure on its suppliers to be much more conscious of how animals are treated and argue on behalf of humane slaughter. I personally believe that the factory farms that we have and the industrialization of livestock that we've seen in the last 30 years is completely inhumane. So there's much more progress to be made. But I think McDonald's has taken some sincere steps in that direction. And what I'm really hoping and what I've really been pushing for ever since Fast Food Nation came out is for McDonald's to take an interest in the two-legged animals in these big beef slaughterhouses, the human beings, because the working conditions in the nation's slaughterhouses have gotten much worse since Fast Food Nation was published. Things are terrible. And if McDonald's were to say tomorrow afternoon at 3 that they would not buy any beef or any chicken or any pork from meatpacking companies where workers are being injured routinely and mistreated or exploited, this industry would change. So I'm a big supporter of the humane treatment of human beings.
Along that line, I know that in your book, you describe words like knocker, sticker, shackler, knuckle dropper, navel boner, splitter top, feed kill chain, etc., all dealing with working in slaughterhouses. Can you explain what some of those mean?
These are just different tasks in the slaughterhouse, and this is an incredibly difficult, dirty, dangerous job. My reporting has led me to spend time with migrant farm workers in this state, strawberry pickers at the very bottom of the economic scale. I've spent time with day laborers doing all kinds of difficult work, and yet the hardest job that I've ever seen in the United States is this slaughterhouse work. It has the highest rate of injury, even though the government no longer says so. When I wrote Fast Food Nation, the rate of injury in American slaughterhouses, the rate of serious injury, was 3 times higher than that of the typical factory, and the rate of cumulative trauma injury was 35 times higher. That's no longer the case. Under the Bush administration, the piece of paper that needs to be filled out when there's an injury at the slaughterhouse has been changed, and voila, injuries dropped by 50%. Now, this was entirely a bookkeeping change, but it did not prevent the American Meat Institute from issuing a press release celebrating the tremendous 50% drop in worker injuries. I've continued to go to meatpacking communities since Fast Food Nation came out, and I can tell you things are much worse now than they were 5 years ago. Workers are being hurt at a terrible rate, and something significant happened yesterday. Most of the Tyson slaughterhouses shut down, and slaughterhouses throughout this country shut down because the workers made very clear that they were going to walk off the job. About 80% of the workers at the nation's slaughterhouses are Latino, mainly non-English-speaking workers who have been exploited and mistreated for many years. And I hope what happened yesterday is the beginning of their getting their rightful place in this society.
If I were to give your book to my 10-year-old cousin, his father would kill me. They are a poor, divorced family and rely on fast food to have time together. What is the McAlternative alternative for poor families?
It's tough. We have a food system right now that is heavily subsidized by the federal government in all the wrong ways. The foods that are very directly subsidized by the government tend to be meats, because of the huge 60% of the income of our corn farmers comes as direct government payments. Cheap corn becomes cheap livestock feed, becomes cheap hamburgers. Cheap corn becomes cheap high fructose corn syrup, which becomes cheap soda, and on and on and on. And the foods that people really need to be eating, like fresh fruits and vegetables, which California produces in abundance, get an indirect subsidy through irrigation projects, et cetera. But farmers who produce fruit and vegetables don't get the same sort of subsidies. So it is true that it can be more expensive to eat healthy. And these fast food chains are very appealing. They're cheap, they're fast, they're convenient, the food tastes pretty good. But as I was saying earlier, the menu price isn't the real price. The real price is a lot higher when you factor in all of the health costs. Now, Marion Nestle, a nutritionist at NYU, has a wonderful book out now called What to Eat. And she really talks about how to eat a healthy diet without having to spend too much money. And there's one calculation that you can get all the servings of fruits and vegetables that you need in a day for about 65 cents a day. But that takes time, it takes effort, it takes education. And, you know, the fast food companies provide something cheap and easy and unthinking. So that's what we're up against. But I think you know, you're not doing a service to your children by taking them to these restaurants on any kind of regular basis, and they may be happy when you take them there, but long term, they're not going to be too happy.
This next question fits right into the one you just answered. Is In-N-Out better? They advertise fresh food. What do you think about Starbucks?
In-N-Out is the one fast food chain in this state that I will still go to. And it's not health food. If you eat too many of their hamburgers or if you eat a lot of their French fries and have their milkshakes, you're going to have the same health problems that you'll have at these other chains. And I haven't even looked into whether they're cooking in trans fats or not. But the reason that I like In-N-Out, well, the food tastes really good. And aside from that, they use entirely fresh ingredients. They use fresh ground beef. They peel the potatoes in the back of the store. It's real ice cream in the shakes. And I also really like the fact that they pay very good wages to their workers. They offer all kinds of health benefits. They really encourage long-term employment. They have a very different attitude toward their workers and towards their customers. They're treating them with a kind of respect and a kind of integrity. And I'm not a paid spokesman. As a matter of fact, they've consistently refused to be interviewed by me. But I think that they're trying to do the right thing in their own way.
Several of the questions I have before
me. And Starbucks?
Yeah.
Starbucks is more problematic. I don't like the way that they drive independent coffee houses out of business. I like a company when they're something unusual about it. When I see that company everywhere I looked, it becomes slightly disturbing. But I give Starbucks real credit in trying to come up with wages and benefits for their service sector workers that are good. I give them credit increasingly for trying to promote fair trade coffee, trying to promote sustainable coffee. And, you know, unfortunately in society, right now, you know, it's easy to say everything's black or everything's white or someone's a hero or someone's a villain, and it's very complex. I certainly would not claim to be pure in all of my behavior, and these companies aren't pure, but some of them are genuinely, sincerely trying to do the right thing, and I would put Costco into that. I think Costco has been under tremendous pressure from Wall Street to cut back on its health care benefits to workers. Its stock price has probably been depressed because it insists on providing good health care to workers. And what's unfortunate about our society at the moment is the companies that try to treat workers well are under pressure, while the companies that, you know, are not providing these benefits are beloved by the stock market. And I think that's a very perverse kind of system of rewards.
At what point can a food, for example, a strawberry milkshake, no longer legally be sold as a strawberry milkshake because it contains no actual strawberries?
That's a very good question. And I think that if a food is going to be sold at a supermarket and it contains no strawberries, I think it has to be strawberry-flavored or artificial strawberry-flavored. But I don't think that necessarily applies at a fast food restaurant. But that's a very good question about the labeling, and I don't know the answer.
I have several people here who have asked, do you eat fast food? And if so, what do you eat?
I eat all kinds of foods. I have a diet that is probably pretty healthy, but I really like chocolate, I really like hamburgers, I really like French fries, and I just try to have the unhealthy foods really in moderation. But I don't go to the big mainstream fast food companies to get the food. I don't want to give them any of my money. I don't want to support them. And when I buy food, I try to use my spending to support food companies that are doing things the right way, locally produced, organic, sustainably produced. When we buy meat that's been produced without antibiotics, without growth hormones, ideally free range. And I think it's possible to eat well and also be supporting the right kinds of producers. It is a bit more expensive. And one of the real goals of this society, I think over the next 10, 15 years, is to make the kind of foods that upper middle class people and well-educated people are now purchasing in abundance affordable to ordinary working people and to the poor. And there is a growth of farmers' markets in low-income areas. But there needs to be much more of sharing of this healthy food with the people who really need it.
Would you talk a little bit about your movie, The Fast Food Nation?
Yeah. There is a movie with the title Fast Food Nation that is going to be premiering at the Cannes Film Festival in about 2 weeks. And it is not for children. It is a drama directed by a wonderful director named Richard Linklater. And it's an independent film made completely outside of the Hollywood system. And it shares the title of my book, Fast Food Nation, but there's nobody in the book that's in the film. It's a way of looking at this country through a town in Colorado where there are a variety of different peoples from different backgrounds and how their lives intersect. And it's a slaughterhouse town. There are ranchers, and there are kids in a high school. It's a tough film, but I feel very proud of it. It really doesn't pull any punches.
And it's coming out when?
Well, it will be seen by human beings for the first time in 2 weeks, and it's actually was the editing and the sound was just finished about a week ago. I didn't expect that anybody would see it until the fall at the earliest, but it was accepted into the competition at Cannes, so people are going to see it in 2 weeks, and I expect some people will be very unhappy about it.
This is Valerie Lewis, co-owner of Hickleby's Bookstore in San Jose, California, talking with Eric Schlosser, author of Chew on This and Fast Food Nation. We're here in San Jose at an event co-sponsored by Hickleby's and the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley. A question I also have for you right here is, what do you view to be the appropriate role of government in addressing the issues that you've presented today?
Yeah. I think the government has a very important role when it comes to issues like labeling. I think it's very important that consumers know what they're eating and can make informed decisions on that basis. I think the government needs to get out of the business of subsidizing heavily on healthy foods. In Fast Food Nation and in Chew on This, I write about the issue of food safety, which the government, I think, has the primary obligation to protect consumers from tainted and dangerous foods, and it's an obligation that this government has really not fulfilled for the past 6 years. I think the government has an important role in protecting children from harm and from exploitation. But I think the government should stay out of the business of telling adults what to do and what they should eat, and I think people should have an enormous amount of freedom. But that freedom is only real if there's choice involved, real choice. And a real choice is an informed choice based on access to information. The information that we get about our food today largely comes from the large food companies. And one of the things I neglected to mention in my talk there, and it somehow just slipped my mind, is the nutritional education that American children now receive comes from the fast food companies, the junk food companies, and the soda companies. The typical American child will watch 20,000 junk food, fast food, soda ads a year. That works out to about 3 hours a week of this junk food advertising. That is the nutritional education that's being provided, and it should come as no surprise that our children have very unhealthy eating habits. So there needs to be a counterbalance. There needs to be restrictions on advertising unhealthy food to kid, and there needs to be much more nutritional education incorporated directly into the curricula at our nation's schools. And Alice Waters at Martin Luther King Middle School in Berkeley is doing an incredible job of teaching kids about food, not just in the classroom, but in a garden there and also in the kitchen. I mean, this is knowledge of fundamental importance to their future health.
Is this kind of arrangement where there's a garden in the school and children are learning about nutrition and hands-on experiences, is that something that you think that the government should be funding?
Absolutely. I think this is something that public schools should be incorporating throughout this country. I mentioned earlier how far removed children are, for the most part, in this largely urban and suburban society, from any knowledge of where food comes from or how it's made. And this is the knowledge. It's so interesting because the knowledge that kids now lack was probably the most important knowledge for all of human history to the last 50 or 60 years. If you didn't have that knowledge, you didn't survive for millennia. So I'm not saying that all of our children should be turned into little hunter-gatherers again, but they certainly need to have the fundamentals of food production and nutrition. And by not giving them that, I think we're really not doing them, we're doing them a real disservice.
There are double messages that we deal with all the time. And I know in our area, Pizza Hut has a book it program that's popular in the schools. And it's designed to encourage children. It's alleged to be designed to encourage children to read. And these children are from preschool up through elementary school. Now, what could the harm be in that?
Pizza Hut may sincerely be interested in children learning how to read. On the other hand, if children succeed in the Book It program, they get a coupon for a free pizza. And these children usually won't go to the restaurant by themselves. They'll usually go with parents or adults who then have to buy a pizza. So there's a mixed motive there. I applaud any company that really wants children to read, and the best thing they could do for the public schools would be to donate books and not market to children in the schools.
I think that's, as an owner of an independent bookstore, I think that's a great
and
idea.
Especially donate books purchased at independent bookstores.
Yeah. I think that's very important. With this many fast food businesses now in the United States, how many of their employees are under the age of 20? And also, isn't this a good opportunity for teenagers to have jobs after school to help them learn responsibility, et cetera?
Fast food jobs were traditionally the jobs for the young, overwhelmingly jobs for teenagers. But the success of McDonald's and the other chains at using low-wage teenagers who often lived at home and didn't need the sort of benefits and income that adult workers might need has encouraged companies throughout the service sector to employ teenagers. And you'll find teenagers working at hotels. You'll find teenagers working at the mall in all kinds of different jobs. And that's put pressure on the fast food chains because they are at the very bottom often in terms of wages and working conditions. So increasingly, you'll find that the workers at America's fast food chains are recent immigrants and sometimes illegal immigrants. There were a number of McDonald's that shut down yesterday as well. And the fast food industry and the restaurant industry wants access to guest workers to bring into this country. I have very ambivalent feelings about kids working at fast food restaurants. On the one hand, there's no question. It teaches basic job skills. Show up on time, learn how to do what you're instructed to do, have enthusiasm, learn what it is to earn money and be responsible for your own money. That's all good. The problem I have with fast food jobs is they have been deliberately, carefully designed and structured to provide as little training as possible. And in Fast Food Nation, I go through this in detail. The convention I attended where all these leading fast food executives were talking about putting as much knowledge as they could into the machinery so that they didn't have to train workers, so they didn't have to pay workers, and so that workers were essentially interchangeable. Now, this is a very unfortunate lesson to be teaching kids who are having their first job, that they're interchangeable, that they're disposable, that there aren't really meaningful skills that they can learn, that there really isn't the possibility for advancement. And I think that if you're going to employ teenagers, there should be more of a sense of what is this job going to provide besides just a paycheck. And I spent a lot of time with fast food workers. I spent a lot of time with teenage fast food workers, and a lot of them became quite alienated and were getting a lesson about work that was the wrong lesson, that they were just a cog in a machine. And I think it's very, very significant that in the fast food industry, according to the restaurant industry's own studies, about two-thirds of all restaurant robberies, fast food robberies, are either employees or former employees or their friends, their inside jobs. And that's an extraordinarily high rate of being robbed at gunpoint by your own workers. And that's a sign of very unhappy workers.
I think I probably have 143 questions left.
Okay.
The problem is I have time for one. I wonder, when you leave here tonight, what you hope to have accomplished speaking to all of us in this large group. And I'm sure that people here will agree with me. We could listen to you a lot longer.
Thank you. I think that the title of this children's book says it pretty well. Chew on this. Think about this. Think. As a writer, if I can get a reader to think, that's all I'm hoping for. Up to that, after that, it's up to each person to come to his own conclusions, change his or her life or not, but to think. And the thing that is most tragic to me is to live a life that's unexamined, to be making choices based completely on other people's marketing and not to be choosing for yourself. So I hope people maybe will think a little more after this evening.
Eric Schlosser, we thank you for all you are doing for us.
Thank you. Well, I hope you were all enlightened and inspired by this evening's program of the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we want to thank Eric Schlosser for his work and his book, Chew on This, Everything You Don't Want to Know About Fast Food. And, of course, to our moderator, Valerie Lewis, co-owner of the Hicklebee's Children's Bookstore, Hicklebee's Children's Bookstore, the Health Trust, and our audience in San Jose, and those of you joining us on the radio. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley, part of the nation's largest and oldest public affairs forum, is adjourned.